We're talking about all those things in our landscape and gardens today. And on that topic of pruning and shade trees, you were mentioning frost damage. Now, I don't know. We usually wait till after the end of the frost. And for the most part, this is a pretty safe time of the year for anyone below about 3,000 foot elevation in Arizona to not worry about frost damage. With that said, we might get it next week. So this advice on trimming frost damage, you might want to hold off a week or two till we see what happens next week. But how do we identify frost damage, especially if it's – can you get frost damage on a deciduous tree?
Sure, sure. Well, it just drops its leaves. It'll get new leaves.
So how can I tell that if it's frost damage, if there's no leaves on it? Is the stem a different color? Do I have to do the scratch test with my fingernail?
Sure, what you're trying to get to. Frost damage, on trees, you just see more in the foliage. And we haven't had any hard freeze that you're going to get some dieback. But if you do, then you just wait for the new growth to emerge. And you can scratch test it to find out what's alive. Most of the frost damage is in shrubs, or I didn't even see any frost damage on the sisus this year. And they're the most frost sensitive of the trees. But most of it is on shrubs, bougainvilleas and lantana. And you just kind of wait for that little bit of emergence of growth and little tiny buds coming out, and you trim back to those buds.
And when you say back to that bud, I mean, one of the things I loved about the frost and the bougainvillea, I would cut it down to the ground.
You can.
Because they grow so fast, by the time the end of the year came, it had outgrown its place, and that was just like its natural trimming cycle.
Well, there is a way to prune a shrub to control it through the season and have the
blooms
and everything.
Ain't nobody got time for that.
Well, I know, but you can take them all the way down to the base. You can. Bougainvilleas, you can. You can. But I checked the calendars because we were going to do some citrus yesterday, and we started our citrus this week, and I think you're safe to do it. I didn't see any cold temperatures through the end of the month. Sometimes we get that one little tiny freeze mid-March, and you can't avoid that. But I didn't see anything coming. I think summer's coming. I felt the sun.
Yeah,
it's like we're already stepping out of the sun into the shade when we're walking properties.
Now, to be clear, you want to remove the fruit first, then trim, correct?
Yes.
Okay.
You want to remove the fruit anyway because you got your spring flush of growth going, and it depends if the fruit's ready. Sometimes different varieties, you want to keep it on longer. But pruning can take off a lot of that weight of the fruit.
And fruit trees in particular, I mean, they're very rarely do you see branch breakage. But, I mean, those lemons trees, the bigger orange trees.
Grapefruits, yeah. Grapefruit. You see a lot of branch breaking. You can see them split in half from the weight of the fruit. So that's why we really try to selectively reduce end weight on them. People like to keep them more into shape, but that's more the stopping that branch split, you know, just psh.
And on citrus, we don't get fruit growth on new, you know, it takes 3 or 4 years before a branch will start producing the fruit. So when you're trimming those, you know, the outside limbs, you can look around and know that, okay, here's where the new growth is coming. We don't need to worry about this for weight control because it's going to come on the more mature branches.
It's all around. The new branches can bring a lot of weight too. I mean, because you get aggressive sprouts. But the thing about reducing and taking the weight off, you're also protecting the interior of the citrus tree and not letting the sun get in there to get sunburn damage.
Which is why you see a lot of the ones, the old style where they would have the white trunk. You know, that wasn't really for decoration. That was for sunscreen
correct,
for the tree.
Correct. You want to let your citrus grow as low as you can to protect the base from the sun. And this is the right time to prune citrus. Between February 15th up to March 15th, even to the end of March, we prune them to give them hard pruners. We can do lighter prunes during the year, you know, lemons that have the little sprouts that go all over the place, as long as you're protecting that bark. That's the most important thing on the citrus.
And there are paints now specifically for citrus tree that are designed to be the color of the bark. So if you have it pruned up or you've got an area that gets a lot of sun, you can put these paints on it that's not a white paint. It just blends in with the color of the
tree. Yeah, there's one called Go Natural Citrus Paint, and I think it's at Ace Hardware. And it looks, it's the color of the bark. And it looks, it's aesthetically not, you know, Sun City White, which is pretty when you drive down those roads. It's all a different.
You have to have them all. You can't just have one painted white. You have to get, if it's uniform, then that's okay. But we've got, I know John's not a big fan of the paints, though. He'd rather see you let it naturally shade itself or wrap it in burlap or something other than a paint.
Well, the trees that I got delivered this year from Greenfield Citrus just had cardboard, you know, and that's what they used to protect their trunks.
Now, you've also got on our talking trees on shrub renovation, and we're, you know, that's the time for, you know, if we don't have frost damage that we're trimming back, what are we looking for in shrub renovation just for this time of year?
Well, it's a good time for shrub renovation, and the difficulty is a lot of landscapers trim things and shear them into balls. And as you do that, you get a lot of growth on the outer part of the bush and nothing on the interior. So the tree's kind of, or the bush is kind of living on the foliage, the food made in the foliage on the outer 5% of the plant. And so it's really on a diet. And so we renovate shrubs to take them down to one-third, take out all the crud out of the beginning, out of the base of them, and you do it to rejuvenate. And so we renovate to rejuvenate and bring new growth and new life so that light penetrates all the way into the base of the shrubs, and you get a lot more natural growth and a lot more flowers. The plant will take less water, and it's aesthetically much more beautiful.
Now, asking a favorite tree is, you know, an impossible question. Asking a favorite shrub is an impossible question. Everyone has their own opinion. But what are shrubs that do well in the low desert?
Any of the Texas sage, a lot of the native shrubs. Tacomas do good. There's just a whole list of shrubs that you could go on the ELCA website, Arizona Landscape Contractors Association. And I think I gave you that for a link. If the listeners want to go on to your website, there's a link there to Arizona Landscape Contractors, and there's a lot of good information. And also, if you want to look on the Landscape Plants for Arizona Deserts, has a great color photographic presentation of plants that do really well with low water.
What shrubs do best for wildlife?
Well, you know, they're really opportunistic, so they're going to try and find really any great branching tree. We see mesquites a lot of time do have a lot of branches there, so we'll see a lot of the doves and sparrows putting nests in there. And then hummingbirds, they're so tiny, and those are the ones that we're going to be worrying about right now. They're really active, and they're probably, if you're taking your morning walk, the parents are probably buzzing by your head right now. Their nests are just so tiny that they can pretty much fit on any of the trees around us. We've seen them as small as going into the center of a chain link fence. That's how tiny hummingbird nests are. The problem then comes with finding that hummingbird nest when you are trimming, because you know that it's nearby because the parent hummingbird is flitting around your head and yelling at you. But that nest is so tiny that you really just have to kind of step back and observe to see where the parent eventually lands, because their nests are made out of cobwebs and little pieces of feathers and everything, and it's smaller than the cup of your hand. Then you get verdin that have satellite nests, and they'll do those also when, you know, your mesquites and Palo Verdes, and they will have a whole system of nests in one area. And so when we go out and survey before we're working with any companies that are having to take trees down for construction or anything, you know, we have to sit there and observe to see which ones are the active ones where the nesting pair actually are having babies as compared to ones that are just a satellite nest that they have their homes. And then, of course, you know, we talked about the palm trees. It's really, we have so many different species of birds, and they're all going to take advantage of every layer of trees and shrubs, and even underground, like the burrowing owls. So very diverse.
Kind of what you were talking about, the microclimates. And so you want a variety of trees, you want a variety of shrubs, so they're always blooming, and they're creating an environment that wildlife and birds can survive in.
And when we're talking about birds and trees and pruning and not pruning and, you know, letting them kind of coexist and help them go along, and you were talking about the hummingbirds and being such a small nest, how can you tell if it's an active nest or not active nest? I mean, and you hear people all the time, well, don't touch it because the mother bird won't ever come back. I'm like, I don't think that's true.
Luckily, you're right. That is not true. That's an old wives' tale that if you touch a baby bird and put it back in its nest, the parents won't come back because birds do not have a sense of smell, really. So whereas mammals have a really keen sense of smell, and that may be true for if you touch a mammal baby, the parents may be a little wary, but birds don't smell at all. So really the way to know that you have an active nest is that parent is going to fly off. Like Gary was saying earlier, you're going to flush it, and all of a sudden you're going to hear those wings. With the hummingbirds, they're tiny but mighty. They will swoop down at you. So it's a lot of observation. And then Fish and Wildlife doesn't consider a nest active until there's actually eggs in it. That's when they become federally protected, once the eggs are actually in there. So that's when you really aren't supposed to be touching them or taking them at that point.
All nests are federally protected if there's an egg in it?
Yeah, pretty much everything that's on the...
I didn't either.
The Migratory Bird Treaty Act pretty much protects almost all those birds that you see. That it's easier to list the ones that aren't protected, and that's the pigeon, the European collared dove, the European starling, the English sparrow, and, the lovebird. They are all introduced species, so they're not actually protected, but mockingbirds, grackles, woodpeckers.
Oh, not those.
woodpeckers are a problem. You know, we were going to talk about that today.
Go ahead.
Okay, so woodpecker damage in trees. That's what I kind of wanted to talk about. And I wanted to ask you about, Laura, because, you know, we have woodpeckers, and I went up and looked up an article by Peter Warren. He's an entomologist for the university, and I found out that woodpeckers or birds actually peck holes in the trees so that sap flows so they attract the insects.
Yeah, it's brilliant. Super smart of them. Unfortunately, yes, that does cause the damage. We get a lot of calls this time of year. You know, there are woodpeckers banging all over my house. My poor daughter is 14 years old and likes to sleep late, and she's got a woodpecker nest in the roof above her, so she hears the babies right at sunrise. So she's asking how we can stop that. We have them at Liberty Wildlife because we have beautiful wood paneling there, and they are trying to peck into there. It's hard as a bird lover, of course, because I love watching it, but we don't like the damage either. So a lot of it is really being on the ball and trying to create motion there to scare them away. So either you come out running out to get them. Some people do those hanging CDs. Some people do little laser lights. And then it's promoting another habitat. So we've actually at Liberty Wildlife put up birdhouses to try and promote them to go into.
I have a Gila woodpecker. It shows up every March and wakes me up and taps on my metal.
Yes.
They are protected, so you can't hurt them.
That is correct. They are protected. So, yeah, you can't do anything to them besides shoo them away. And they will bang on metal. When I worked at the zoo, actually, there was a metal trailer that we had one that every day was banging on it. They actually say that might be a form of them communicating to say that that's their territory.
The territory.
You know, it's more of a territorial
exactly.
thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Oh,
and they do like the metal roofs. But the other thing we see with woodpeckers is that they're a lot of times going after the flathead borers inside the bark. So flathead borers kind of live underneath in the cambium of the tree until they're large enough to go to the center and turn into a beetle and come out, and they leave a little oval hole. But the woodpeckers go after them as a source of food. So a lot of times woodpecker damage is an indication of a problem.